Ephesians chapter 4, we're going to read verses 1 through 3. Therefore, the prisoner of the Lord beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called, with all lowliness and meekness, with longsuffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. We are moving on this morning from humility to meekness. We said a little bit about that this morning during the prayer service. But in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul is making a transition from what has been a primarily doctrinal section of the letter. There's only one command in Ephesians chapters 1 through 3, and that is to remember, in the sense of believing, to remember something. Once you get into Ephesians chapter 4 and you make your way through chapter 6, there's one command after the next, after the next, after the next. And what Paul is doing is he's making a connection in Ephesians chapter 4, and he's saying, based on what I've told you, this makes sense. Now, I think it's important that we understand that that's what he's saying. Not just based upon what I've told you, you ought to do this. But what he's saying is, as you consider the realities of Ephesians 1, 2, and 3, it just makes sense that you would pursue humility. As you consider the realities of Ephesians 1, 2, and 3, it just makes sense that you would pursue meekness. So forth and so on. And so, this morning, we're going to look at meekness. We are called to make every effort. The word endeavor in verse 3 is it could also be translated just to make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. That's specifically in the context of the church, as Paul is writing about it in Ephesians chapter 4, but that same principle could be applied to every relationship that you have. And so one of the ways that we make every effort is to walk in all humility and to walk in all meekness. And so what is meekness when we think about pursuing that, when we think about what that means as a character quality? Spend a little bit of time trying to get a clear picture of that. If you look it up in a dictionary, meekness means gentleness of mind. One of the things you'll notice if you look through various translations, English translations of the Bible, is that a lot of times the word meekness is the word gentleness is substituted there for it. Meekness, gentleness. I think it's important, again, to point out the idea of gentleness of mind. It's the way you're thinking about something. Same way humility works. There's a mildness, a humility, a graciousness, it's a kindness. I think probably the best definition for us to try to keep in our minds for meekness is just a gentleness of mind, the disposition of gentleness. A few other things here, if we were to expand that out. We mentioned this on a Wednesday night a couple of weeks ago, but it's the temper of spirit in which we're able to accept God's dealings with us as good, and therefore without disputing or resisting. To be meek is to be able to accept God's dealings with you as good. To be able to accept things that you don't want to accept, really is where the emphasis would lie there. To be able to accept hard things. To be able to accept, and if we were to kind of boil it down, to be able to accept things that you do not like. To be able to accept that things work out sometimes in ways that you would have never planned and would have never chosen. And to be able to accept that there is a loving, kind God who does everything after the counsel of his own will, who loves you, has redeemed you, has adopted you, and he is working those things for good. The ability to accept that is meekness. Okay? Look in Jeremiah 26. In Jeremiah 26, verse 14, we see meekness coming out of Jeremiah as he says this, "As for me, behold, I am in your hand. Do with me as seemeth good and meet to you." That's Jeremiah's heart there in Jeremiah 26. If we know just a cursory knowledge of Jeremiah, you realize that Jeremiah's ministry was a terribly difficult ministry. It was a ministry that in many ways was a completely unsuccessful ministry, if we think about it in the terms of Jeremiah preaching these great messages and all the people turned and responded. It was completely successful for what God had in mind. God's plan for Jeremiah's ministry was that he would preach and the people would ignore, and then they would be condemned, and then they would be carried off into captivity. And Jeremiah says here in verse 14, "As for me, behold, I am in your hand. Do with me as seemeth good and meet to you." What does that mean? Jeremiah just says, "Here I am, Lord. Here I am. And you do what you think is right, or you do what seems right to you." Now we have to just acknowledge, before we say another word about meekness, that this is something that has to be a supernatural thing. No one naturally comes to that conclusion. No one naturally musters up the ability to say, "This is not what I wanted. I don't naturally like it, but I think that I'll will myself to like it anyway." That doesn't happen. And so when we're thinking about meekness, the same way with humility, and as we think about patience and forbearance, there's no point of arrival when it comes to meekness. Meekness is something that you will continue to grow into. You'll never get to the place to where you say, "Okay, I've licked meekness. That's something that I've just got down. I don't have to put any effort into being meek anymore." That's not the picture. That's not the case in any of these qualities that we're thinking about. But meekness is a character trait that has to be exercised again and again and again and again. And so what Jeremiah says, he says, "Here I am, I'm in your hands, and you do with me what you think is right." He's going to have to tell himself that again and again and again and again. It's not an arrival point. He's not a super saint. One of the ways that helps me think about what it means to be meek is that in meekness, it's okay for us to ask for what we want, and it's got to be okay for us to be told no. It's okay. That, I think both of those are important to understand. Sometimes people think that they're meek and they're humble because they just don't ask for anything. You know, it's almost an ascetic kind of thing. You punish yourself by pretending like you don't have any desires or suppressing any of the desires that you might have. Listen, some of the desires that we have are good. Some of the things that we don't get are not necessarily bad things. And when it comes to meekness, the ability to exercise meekness, not just toward God, but toward one another, it's got to be okay for us to let our desires be known, and then it's got to be okay for God or someone else to tell us no. And that's where the difficult part comes in, isn't it? Because typically, by the time we're willing to make our desires known, they make complete sense to us. Typically, we can't see it any other way, or if we can, it's just barely. And the difficulty with meekness, again, is just learning to be okay with being told no. A.W. Pink puts it this way: "Meekness is the opposite of self-will towards God and ill will towards men." Meekness is the opposite of self-will toward God. What that means is meekness realizes that I'm not God. I'm not God, and God's not on some puppet strings that I get to manipulate and get him to do the things that I want him to do. I'm not going to act toward God in a self-serving type way. And then ill will toward men, because men don't do what I wish they would. Lastly, as far as what is meekness, A.W. Tozer says, "The meek man is not a human mouse afflicted with a sense of his own inferiority. Rather, he may be in his moral life as bold as a lion and as strong as Samson, but he has stopped being fooled about himself." He has stopped being fooled about himself. What does that mean? Fooled about what? Well, in general, fooled about the lie that I know better than you all the time, and that if I were God, I could do things better. Now, no one's going to get up and preach a message with those two things being the primary points, but when we become upset, whenever we become shaken, whenever we become rattled, typically it's because of one of those two things. You didn't do what I wanted you to do, or God didn't do what I wanted him to do. And so, just based on that understanding, based upon that reality, this is what meekness is. You can see where the opposite of meekness would be a disaster for unity. So if meekness is the ability to accept God's dealings with us as good, and therefore without disputing or resisting, if we were to take the other side of that, the opposite of meekness would be what I hoped or what I would deal myself is good. And that's the only thing I can accept. Anything that falls outside of that just won't work. Meekness calms us down. It quiets our spirits. Again, whenever we're told no. The opposite of that is, come hell or high water, you will never tell me no and get away with it. You will never act in a way that I don't want you to act and get away with it. You can see where that's a disaster for unity, right? You can see where that's a disaster for any type of relationship. And yet, in our fallen sinfulness, that tends to be one of the reoccurring problems that we struggle with day after day, a lack of meekness. We don't say it that way. If those words were to actually come out of our mouth, we might be shocked. But if we could watch a video of our lives over the past week, and we were to take the words out and just watch the actions, or maybe we could leave the words in, I think we would see the story of people who just struggled to accept God's dealings with our lives as good, and to not buck against that. That not just being with him, but with other people. And so let's look at meekness or gentleness and the character of Jesus Christ. So part of sanctification in the sense of, or in the meaning of, that we're being conformed to the image of Jesus. Part of what that means is growing in meekness, because as Jesus talks about himself, the way that he describes himself is by being humble and meek. Look in Matthew chapter 11. This will be a familiar passage for you. Matthew chapter 11. In verse 28, Jesus says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart." That lowly in heart is humble. "I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest unto your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And so, again, we said this with humility, but if you want to know what meekness looks like, then read the Gospels. Jesus is a meek man. You find out as you read the Gospels again that meekness doesn't mean that he becomes a mouse. But you'll also find out that meekness does mean that he's not focused on himself. He's not focused on his own will. And if you want to know what gentleness looks like, look at Jesus Christ. "I am meek and lowly." Also, in 1 Peter chapter 2, we get another glimpse at what meekness looked like. 1 Peter chapter 2, starting in verse 21, 1 Peter 2:21. "For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but he committed himself unto him that judgeth righteously. Now we could continue on and you could see what else Christ endured, but essentially he says this: when he was wrongfully accused, he didn't say a word. When he suffered, he did not lash back. He didn't threaten. Why? Because he was able to accept God's dealings with him as good. That's what it says. He committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean if you're in some kind of abusive situation, then you ought to just be meek and leave yourself there and be completely inactive and never do anything? No, that's not what that means. Jesus knew what the will of God was. Jesus knew what his purpose was to come and to die for his people. Jesus was acting in accordance with God's will, and even though it was painful for him, he did it. Even though it was uncomfortable for him, he did it. He endured it, and he did it in a way that was, again, in accordance with God's will. It's not just that he suffered well. Notice it did not say, when he was reviled, he reviled again. When he suffered, he began to threaten. All this in line with the fact that he committed himself to him who judges righteously or rightly. Meekness assumes that you're going to be uncomfortable, and meekness assumes that there's going to be suffering in your life, and meekness asks the question, how are you going to respond? How are you going to deal with that? How are you going to think about that? When we look at Jesus, we see meekness in the sense that he was willing to endure suffering without lashing out sinfully, because he was able to entrust himself to God, who does what's right, who judges rightly. And so that's gentleness and the character of Jesus. The remainder of this is going to be where Paul has it, and that is gentleness in our Christian walk. Gentleness in your daily life. Meekness in your daily life. Look back in Ephesians chapter 4. I want to notice a few things here. Therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, Ephesians 4:1, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called, with all lowliness and meekness, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And I know I left the last two out there. The first point that I want to make as far as gentleness or meekness in your life is that you are commanded to grow in meekness. It's an imperative. You also find the same one in Colossians. If you look in Colossians chapter 3, verse 12, put on therefore as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercy, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness. Put these things on, Paul says. It's a command. It's an imperative. It's not optional. It's not a good recommendation or something that you might do if you have a little bit of spare time, but growing in humility and growing in meekness is a command, which means a couple of things. We said the first one. Number one, it means it's not optional. But number two, it means you're going to have to put some effort into doing this. Growing in Christian character, growing in sanctification, while it does depend upon the work of the Spirit in someone's life, sanctification never happens by accident. You are never going to accidentally become meek. You may accidentally... when I say accidentally, you may unintentionally lash out in anger, but you're never going to unintentionally accidentally act meek. You may unintentionally swell up in pride, but you're never going to accidentally humble yourself. And so I think that's important as we think about any of these qualities. They're not things that you trip upon, stumble upon. We've made mention of this before with sanctification, but sometimes people have the idea that what's going to happen is you'll pray about it, and then God's going to zap you with a lightning bolt of meekness, and you're going to be meek from here on out. That's not the way it works either. It doesn't work that way. You are commanded to be meek, not to wait on meekness. You're commanded to be meek, And the command implies that you're supposed to do something. You're not commanded to do things that are outside of your control and outside of your power. Paul says, put these things on in Colossians. In Ephesians, he says, based on everything that's happened, everything you've been given, all that God has done, walk in meekness. Now, as we do that, I think we have to keep in mind that even though we're not passive in walking in meekness, we still are dependent on the power of the Holy Spirit. Okay? So it's not accidental in the sense that God's going to pull your puppet strings and you're going to be meek. But it's also not a self-willed type thing. It's not something to where you just make up your mind and in your own strength you're going to be meek. It's something to where you have to humbly approach it with the realization that if it's not for the power of the Holy Spirit, I can't do this. But with the power of the Holy Spirit, I can. And look in Galatians 5. This will be, again, a familiar passage for you, but laying out the fruit of the Spirit. Galatians 5:22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. A few things about this. Number one, the what's under consideration here is the fruit of the Spirit. This is fruit singular, not plural. So it's not that Paul in Galatians 5:22 is naming out all these different fruits of the Spirit, plural. Paul is saying, if you have the Spirit in you, this is the fruit, singular, that comes out of that. And one of the things that Paul has on the list is meekness. So what does that mean? It means this. It means if you're a Christian, then you have the ability for meekness to be cultivated in your heart and in your life. There's not a single Christian that statement is not true of. Why do I say that? Because sometimes when we think about character development, whenever we think about humility, meekness, patience, long-suffering, we start thinking in the realms of personality traits more than we do cultivated fruit. So you may think, well, somebody's personality is just, you know, kind of given to that, and meekness is not my personality. Well, good news is meekness is not about personality. It's about the Holy Spirit bringing forth fruit in your life. Has nothing to do with your personality. Matter of fact, the idea of laying this stuff off on personality a lot of times can be very deceptive, because meekness and patience can look a whole lot like indifference and apathy. And how can you tell the difference between the two? Well, it depends on who's producing it, right? I mean, you can have an apathetic personality, but that doesn't mean that you're meek. You can be indifferent and never get worked up about anything because you don't care about anything, but that's not a virtue, and it's certainly not a fruit of the Spirit. And so this is not a personality trait. This is a character quality that's cultivated through the Holy Spirit, because you have been given the Spirit and that fruit is being cultivated or developed in you. I want to hit the principle that we find in Philippians that balances this out. In Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 12. Wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God which worketh in you both the will and to do of his good pleasure. And so here in Philippians 2, we see the cooperation. You may come up with a better word for that, but you see the cooperation there of the believer and the Spirit. You work out your own salvation. How am I going to do that? Because it's God who's working in you both the desire and the ability to do his good will or to do his good pleasure. And so, again, it's fruit that's being cultivated. You're active. God is active. And it's being developed. 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Uh, as Paul is encouraging Timothy in these things, he says in verse 11, "But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness." Now, the reason I go there is because Paul says to Timothy, you need to flee some things. In other words, you need to turn. You need to turn away from some things. But the word follow after there is the same word for pursue. You need to be pursuing righteousness, all that goes in there, and then finally, meekness. You need to be pursuing meekness. You need to be running after meekness. In other words, meekness needs to be on your radar. You know, when we think about any of these, really, in the context of overall spiritual development, overall spiritual maturity, they really are essential. In James chapter 3, James makes a connection for us that we might not naturally make left to ourselves. Look in James chapter 3, verse 13. He says, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom." There's a couple of ways that James chapter 3, verse 13 might surprise us. Number one, he says, who is a wise man? Essentially, we could ask the question, how would you describe a wise man? Who is it that has knowledge among you? And James says, if you have wisdom, if you have knowledge, then show that out of the way that you order your behavior, out of the way that you live your life. One thing that you'll notice very quickly is that James does not delegate wisdom just to the realm of thought, knowledge, what you know. James makes the leap between what you know and what you do, and the assumption that James makes is, if what you know is not showing up in your life, then you don't really know it. Wisdom is not this treasury of facts that you have stored up in your head. Wisdom happens as God's word permeates your heart, permeates your life, and your behavior is ordered after what you know. And James says, let a wise man show out of the good conversation, order of his behavior, out of the good conversation, his works with meekness of wisdom. And so, wisdom doesn't exist outside of meekness. Wisdom is not on display outside of meekness. The other things I want to point out before we make our shift over to a different area is that God has chosen meekness as one of the essential ingredients for the church. God has chosen meekness as one of the essential ingredients for the church. Let me give you a few of those. Look in Galatians chapter 6. Verse 1, "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted." Now, I think we could all say that we would, as we think about what it means for the church to function and the way that God has called us to function, that part of that would be the restoration of those who have fallen, right? We would not have any issues with that. There are times where people have this idea that there are only certain people in the church who are qualified to help restore people who are fallen, and that's just simply not true. As Paul is talking about exhorting the folks in the churches in Galatia, he's not talking to the pastors in Galatians 6:1. He's talking to the brethren, to the members there. And he says, if someone is overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, restore that person. Well, that's good. Everybody would be okay with that. You know, you have someone who's fallen. Those who are of the Spirit work to restore. How in the world do you restore someone with a spirit of meekness, Paul says? Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. You see, one of the difficulties in restoration, and I think one of the reasons that it's so tempting to try to delegate the work of restoration to just a specific few, is because it is hard to be meek when you're dealing with someone who has fallen, in the sense that perhaps they're blinded to their own self, perhaps they're hard-hearted and stubborn. Or perhaps you know that person, you have a history with that person, and in your mind you've already got the word idiot tattooed over their forehead. And God says, be gentle. Be gentle. Restore that person with a spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. And so we could talk about that a lot more, but just leave it at, as God calls us to restore people in the church, that's to be done with a spirit of meekness. And 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Verse 24. Paul tells Timothy, the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient, in meekness instructing those that oppose themselves, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth. We could go on there, but we'll stop. When it comes to preaching the word, when it comes to teaching the word, Paul makes it very clear here that it's to be done with gentleness and meekness. Gentleness and meekness. Why? Because people do not always respond the way you think they're going to respond. I mean, that's just the truth. The truth is, meekness in the sense of, this is not about me. Okay? So I'll just say a few things and move on. But it would be easy to make it a lot about me. Because I've been thinking about this, studying this, for at least a week. As you know, I get come up and I have an hour, and you know, typically the most important message that a preacher has is the one he's about to preach, and so they've thought about it, they're invested in it, and this and that. You preach it, and before you know it, after the service is over, somebody comes up and they have a question about something that you just know you laid out clearer than anybody in the history of mankind could have laid out. And you think, what were you doing the last hour when I just skillfully unfolded that in a way that even a toddler could understand? You know what the truth is? The truth is, a lot of times, pastors expect a whole lot more out of their flocks than they expect out of themselves. Here's what I mean by that. You know, I may ask you at lunch, or if I see you sometime after the message, you know, if we were talking about the sermon and you say, you know what, it was good, I know it was good, there was something that really stuck, but I just can't remember it. And I could think, what in the world? What do you mean you can't remember it? It's only been 30 minutes. It's only been an hour. How do you not remember it? Especially if you remember something about it being good. Well, here's a little secret. Half the time I don't remember what I preached the day after. I've got to go back and refer to my notes if I get a question about it. If I'm not honest with myself about that, I could get really irritated and take it as a big insult. Now, I've given you two reasons why we might have to struggle with meekness. There are a multitude of others, but leave it to just to say, if a pastor is going to teach and preach in a way that is God prescribed, then I have to be concerned with meekness. I have to be concerned with meekness. And then I'm not going to turn there, but in 1 Peter 3:15, be ready to give an answer to those who would ask of the hope that's within you with all meekness. If you're going to witness in a way that is consistent with what God has called you to, then you're going to witness with meekness or in meekness. Now, I want to spend the rest of my time this morning and this afternoon thinking about this in a practical way, in the sense of gentleness. Okay? So one of the important aspects of meekness that we're going to have to wrestle with in our daily lives, whether we're talking about in the context of the church, and that's what Paul's referring to here, in the context of your family, in the context of the workplace, in the context of life, one of the aspects of meekness that is high on the importance list is the ability to control your anger. Okay, so if you want another picture of what it looks like for meekness to be absent, it's for you to not be able to control your anger. Anger is the result of you perceiving that you've been wronged. So you can see how that fits in with the definition of the inability to be able to accept God's dealings with you as good, the inability to be able to accept other people's dealings with you as good or fair or right. And so I want to give you several different aspects of that. Number one, gentleness or meekness is the ability to distinguish between righteous anger and sinful anger. Okay? Gentleness or meekness is the ability to be able to distinguish between righteous anger and sinful anger. And just so I don't lose you, I just want to make clear again as we go through this next part, I'm pitting anger against gentleness. Okay? If you don't have gentleness, then you have frustration, irritability. Both of those words are just nice ways of saying anger. Okay? That's what those are. And that's what comes out. Look in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. So the first thing we said, gentleness is the ability to be able to distinguish between righteous anger and sinful anger. And the reality is that anger is not always sinful, right? When we were preaching through Mark, we saw that Jesus became angry at the Pharisees. That's not sinful. God is angry with the wicked every day. That's not sinful. But Ephesians chapter 4 has anger here in both of its senses, both in a righteous and an unrighteous sense. The first one we're going to see in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, Paul says, "Be angry and sin not." Be angry and sin not. Now, one of the interesting things about verse 26 and that little phrase, "be angry," is that that is a command. Now, you may not have known that the Bible commands you to be angry, but the truth is there are times where it is right to be angry. And the reason that we know that is because God always does what's right, and He becomes angry at times, right? So, be angry and sin not. So, anger is not always sinful. If you jump down a little bit to verse 31, you see all the sinful or some of the sinful manifestations of anger. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. Now, those are the manifestations of anger that are supposed to be put away. So what does that mean? Well, it means this. It is possible for anger to exist without bitterness. Okay? It's possible for anger to exist without wrath. It's possible for anger to exist without evil intentions, evil speaking without malice or a intent to harm. It's possible for anger to exist without any of those things. One of the ways that that may be helpful in trying to distinguish, and I don't want to overstate this, but typically if you're trying to figure out whether or not your anger is righteous or unrighteous, you should not just assume that it's righteous. Your default mode is unrighteous anger. That just tends to be the way it is. That doesn't mean you can't experience righteous anger, but if you're wondering which of the two you might have, you'd be better off starting out assuming that it's unrighteous and trying to move toward the other side. When your anger is due to the concern that a holy God has been offended, that could be righteous anger. Okay? Whenever your anger is due to the fact that God has been offended by something someone else has done, by something that you yourself have done, that can be righteous anger. But when your anger is based upon the fact that somebody prevented you from having what you wanted, even if that something was something good, if your anger is based upon the fact that you didn't get what you wanted, that anger is unlawful. It's unrighteous. It's sinful anger. That's the kind of anger that tends to cause bitterness. That's the kind of anger that tends to lead to evil speaking, so forth and so on. You say, well, you know, I think there are probably times where I am offended that God is offended. You know, I am upset because God didn't get what he wanted, but you know, there are also maybe some traces of the other. I'm offended because I took it personal as well. And the truth is that can happen, right? You can be concerned about a good thing and go about trying to get it the wrong way. The reality that the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God. You can be so concerned about holiness. You can be so concerned about doctrinal integrity and doctrinal purity. You can be concerned that the church is headed in the right direction. And yet that concern can be twisted a little bit. Not so much concerned that God is going to be offended, but the concern can be, I'm never going to let this happen, and you begin to handle it in a way that is not God prescribed. It's sinful. And so one of the helps may be, not just in a church, but in your family as well, one of the helps may be, whenever you find yourself angry and you're trying to determine whether or not it's righteous anger or unrighteous anger, just ask yourself the question, how far am I willing to go to get this? Is it so important that I'm willing to sin against God on the pretense that it's for his glory? And we don't think about those things in that kind of depth while we're in the moment, but typically that tends to be what we do. I'm upset because you're slandering God's name, and so I'm going to intentionally disobey God, chew you out, and God be the glory. And it doesn't turn out well. And God's not pleased with it. This is pretty close-knit to that. Gentleness is refusing to allow any desire to become so deep-rooted that it produces anger. Gentleness is refusing to allow any desire to become so deep-rooted that it produces anger. And when we're talking about this kind of anger, it's sinful anger. Well, that's hard, isn't it? One of the things about pride that we mentioned is that pride tends to blind us, doesn't it? You'll never meet a proud person who really sees how proud they are. You'll never see your pride as you're swallowed up in it. Typically, a proud person, if they were to analyze themselves, they're the only person in the room that can see things the way they really are. They're the most balanced person in the room. They've got the most sense. They just can't understand why everybody else does not have this clarity of mind and insight like they have. And the truth is, that kind of attitude is usually, we convince ourselves of that, and we are completely blind to the realities of what's actually going on. And so, leaving the possibility open that what I desire may not be good for me to have. What I desire in the moment may not be good for me to have. Number three. This is where it's, I think this may be the most practical as far as your relationships within the church and particularly within your family would go. But gentleness is knowing how to harness anger so that it may be used to destroy those things that God would approve being destroyed. Now, that may seem like an odd thing to say or an odd way to put it. But here's the truth. If anger is not always wrong, then God intends anger to accomplish something. Righteous anger is intended to accomplish something. We use this picture whenever we talked about fear, it may have been a year ago now, but when we think about emotions, if we think about them like a smoke alarm, in the sense of that they're there to let us know something's not right. God put them there, and they're there to let us know something is not right. And so typically, anger comes up when there's a problem. Anger comes up typically when there's a problem. Now, just from what we know about what the Scriptures say, about what Jesus says, in a fallen world, are we ever going to live in a state that is problem-free? No, we're not. I tend to see things one way, and some of that's not going to be because it's bad. Some of that's not going to be sinful. The truth is, you may have a preference, I may have a preference, and one's not any better than the other. It's just my preference. I want to do things this way, you want to do things that way, and that's okay. God would allow that. But if there's a problem that comes up, if you take offense at that in some way, then you become angry. And angry tends to get our attention to let us know that there's something wrong. And then the question is, how are we going to respond to that? How are we going to respond to that? You may get a little more concrete if you think about the most common relationships that you have. So you may ask yourself, how do you respond to anger whenever your spouse makes you angry, whenever your parents make you angry, whenever your children make you angry, whenever you get angry, you know, at folks at church or your friends? How do you typically respond? Well, there are two typical responses. Number one, these are typical sinful responses. Number one, whenever we become angry, we just withdraw and we just clam up. We don't say a word. You made me mad. You did something I didn't like. And so I don't have anything else to say to you. I'm going to punish you by not talking to you, by letting you know I'm finished with you. Now, I'm not going to let you know that. I certainly wouldn't vent my anger toward you, but I'm just not talking to you anymore. Anybody in here clam up? You don't have to raise your hand. I know who you are. A church full of people who clam up will never walk in unity. Never, ever walk in unity. People who clam up, who withdraw, who decide that they're going to give people the silent treatment, will never walk in unity. The other alternative, people may not clam up, you may just blow up. You may just blow up. You get upset and you just let folks know what's on your mind, and somehow, in some skewed way, maybe you've even convinced yourself that that is a mark of just how genuine you are. You're not going to pretend. You're not going to act like things don't bother you when they do. If you've got something on your mind, you're going to let whoever needs to know all about it. I'm not a hypocrite. It typically tends to be the normal justification of people who like to blow up or who tend to blow up. Now look in Proverbs 29. Verse 11, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in until afterwards. A fool uttereth all his mind. You know, Proverbs also says that it's a fool who vents all of his anger. And so you can either clam up, you can blow up. We said earlier it's impossible for unity to be kept if you are someone who clams up and withdraws. It's not any better for someone who blows up, is it? What happens typically whenever people just do not have a handle on their anger, on their temper, and they blow up and they blow up and they blow up, and eventually it just becomes easier for everybody to avoid that person. Real, genuine communication almost becomes impossible. Now, again, we're talking about meekness, we're talking about gentleness, and we're talking about unity. And so we haven't hit a rabbit trail here. We're just talking about the nuts and bolts of how this stuff actually works. When you get angry, if it leads you to blow up or clam up, that means we have work to do. And here's what I know about everybody in this room. Everybody in here either tends to blow up or clam up or have some combination of the two. Probably a combination of the two. Okay? Probably you either blow up and then clam up, or you clam up and then finally blow up when somebody finally gets out of you what it is that's been bothering you. But there is no unity that takes place with those kinds of things. And so what you end up doing is destroying a relationship. Now, we said earlier that meekness is using your anger to only destroy that which God would approve of being destroyed. And we know that God does not approve of us destroying relationships between our brothers and our sisters. And so what do you think anger would help us destroy? Well, one of the things that anger can motivate us to do, if we are thinking about it rightly, if we're thinking about it biblically, the thing that needs to be destroyed or resolved when anger comes up is the actual problem, the actual issue. And that tends to be the last thing that comes around in conversation, because it is humiliating sometimes to admit the things that we become angry about, isn't it? Remember when I said it's got to be okay for us to be able to tell people what we want, and then it's got to be okay for us to be able to, or we have to learn to be okay with people telling us no? That sounds like a good pre-K lesson, doesn't it? And yet we still try to figure that out. We still have a hard time with that. It's humiliating to be able to admit some of the things that we get upset about, some of the things that make us bitter, some of the things that make us angry. And yet, in Ephesians 4, we are commanded to speak truth in love. You see, that's the opposite of blowing up and clamming up. It's not that you, instead of blowing up, you just don't talk. It's that you speak in love. And then the other side of the coin is, it's not that you're so great because you don't blow up, you just clam up. The reality is you are commanded, it's a command in Ephesians 4, you are commanded to speak and to speak truth. And it's the humble and the meek person who will approach a problem in a way that doesn't avoid it, doesn't compound it, but addresses it. If you think about it this way, this has been a helpful image for me. One of the blessings of anger is is that you can choose what to do with it. And so someone said that anger is like a dart that God gives you. And when you're in a conflict and anger arises, you can take that dart and you can throw it at the other person, but that just hurts them. You can take that dart and you can clam up and swallow it. That doesn't do anything but hurt you. Or you can take that dart and you can throw it at the problem. You can throw it at the issue. And you can resolve it. All your energy, all your focus, all your time. And it usually doesn't take much. For the majority of the little problems that pop up, can be focused there. And you can actually resolve the problem. Now, we're getting close to the end, and I hope I haven't lost you as far as how this relates to meekness. Here's what I know about people, not just because the Bible says, but just in my experience of sitting down with people, of trying to help people work through different conflicts. Here's what I know. People don't do conflicts well, including myself. I'm not putting myself above anybody here. And what happens whenever you get a group of people together that don't do conflicts well and conflicts arise, then you either create a culture where we ignore each other, you create a culture where we're not reconciled, we're divided against each other, or you learn how to deal with the problems God's way. You learn how to deal with the problems God's way. A meek person will deal with the problems God's way in a way that's gentle but honest, in a way that he can speak the truth in love. One more, and then we'll come back this afternoon. Gentleness or meekness involves knowing how to think during times when you're provoked. Gentleness or meekness involves knowing how to think when you're provoked to anger. Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Here's a part of what it means to love somebody. Let me start in verse 4. Charity suffers long. It's kind. Charity envies not. Charity vaunteth not itself. It's not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, here it is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil. Thinketh no evil, is not easily provoked. How in the world do you not become easily provoked? We could also ask the question, how is it that you do become easily provoked? That might be a good way to start. Have you ever been talking to a friend or a spouse and everything seems to be going just fine and you say something that happens to hit some kind of a raw nerve and the response that you get came from outer space and you're not sure what just happened? Anybody? I see a few smirks. We've got somebody raising his hand. Yeah, that happens. That happens. And the reason that that happens, and this is not a once and for all statement, but one of the reasons that that happens, maybe I should say, is because we allow ourselves to be irritable, more irritable than we actually have to be. One of the reasons that that happens is because when we receive a comment that we don't like, and it may just be a little bump, it may not even be anything big, something happens to rub us the wrong way, then we retrieve the boatload of insults, hurts, irritations, whatever else that we've been tucking away back there that we haven't really dealt with. And a little bitty passing comment can spark World War III. Why? Because we are easily provoked. We allow ourselves to be easily provoked. We allow ourselves to think evil. To think evil. In the same way, I know this has happened. And if it hasn't, then hold off. It'll happen before too long. You've made a comment to somebody and somebody took an offense to it and you say, I didn't mean it that way. That's not the way I meant it. And the more you try to convince them, the less convincing you become. And they can just be settled. Or maybe we can take it that way. Maybe somebody makes a comment to us and it hurts our feelings or it makes us angry. And they convince us that's not the way they meant it. And we just can't be convinced otherwise. Well, again, that's not in line with this idea of not easily provoked, not thinking evil. Look also in 2 Corinthians. This will be our last place, one of the last places. 2 Corinthians, chapter 10, starting in verse 4. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Now, I go to that verse just to make the point that you are not called to be passive in the way you think. Now, perhaps whenever you think about this verse in the past, you've thought about it in an apologetic way or in a way that encourages you that you need to get your doctrine right and those sorts of things. And that's fine, and that's a good application. But brothers and sisters, this is a passage that makes its way into every area of our life and every kind of thought that we have. This is the kind of passage that you need to think about when every time your parents say something to you, the thought that comes into your head is, they're so ridiculous, they're so unfair. This is the kind of passage that ought to come into our minds whenever we are in a state of conflict, whenever we're in a bad mood, whenever we're in a whatever with our spouse, and they can't do anything that seems to be right or that doesn't irritate us. This is the kind of passage we ought to be thinking about, bringing every thought captive as we're interacting with people who just tend to rub us the wrong way. And this is the kind of passage that we ought to be thinking about when we think about what it means to have a gentleness of mind, which is meekness. Gentleness of mind. Now, we're going to stop because we're a little over right now, and we'll come back this afternoon to finish up. But just based off what we've seen so far, you can see why this is not one of those things to where we say, here's meekness, now go get it, right? God has called us to a high standard when we think about meekness, and a difficult standard when we think about meekness. And so may we pursue meekness with humility and dependence upon the Holy Spirit.
Thank you for listening to this message. Our prayer is that you've been blessed by the messages and the daily devotional blog on sermon audio from Ripley Primitive Baptist Church. We would love the opportunity to be of greater service to you and your walk with Christ. In other words, we would like to get to know you better. Do you have need of counsel, of a home church, or can we just pray for you? Please feel free to contact us by phone at 662-837-8590 or visit our website at www.ripleypbc.com.